Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Karen Russell's latest novel, The Antidote, brings us to the Dust Bowl era, centering on the fictional town of Uz, Nebraska, where we follow a prairie witch known as The Antidote, who serves as a living repository for the townspeople's memories. As a catastrophic dust storm descends, their fates converge, unearthing buried secrets and confronting the town's troubled past. Russell's novel is a reckoning with a nation's forgetting, enacting the settler amnesia and willful omissions passed down from generation to generation, unearthing not only horrors, but many possibilities. Karen Russell is the author of six works of fiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Swamplandia and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. She is a MacArthur Fellow, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The new book is in my hand. It is The Antidote, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Karen Russell back to the Book Show. How are you?
I'm doing good, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a delight to have you back on the program. There's so much to talk about this because this is such a deep book and it has such weight and beauty to it. I guess the most obvious or maybe the first question that comes to my mind, which is what brought you to the Dust Bowl?
Well, it is such an obvious question, and I keep like flubbing this answer. I think because it's a little enshrouded in dust for me now, too. I was writing Swamplandia, which is set in the Florida Everglades. There's a section in that book, The Dredge Man's Revelation, that is an Army Corps of Engineers dredge and fill campaign during the 1930s that the Civilian Conservation Corps was involved with. And some members of my own family worked for the CCC, the WPA. So the Great Depression was sort of like at the edge of living memory, right? Like the stories that I heard as a kid. And I think the Dust Bowl always fascinated me. Our family's home was destroyed in Hurricane Andrew. And right around that time, I read The Grapes of Wrath, which was like, you know, one of the first adult novels I read and imprinted so strongly on me. So I think something about that story felt resonant to me as a kid who we lost our home. Everybody existed under the hammer of that same weather, right? Like this Category 5 storm leveled South Florida. But then I also saw, you know, we got insurance money. We did eventually rebuild. We came back. And there were other communities that are quite literally swept off the map in the aftermath of Andrew. So I think I was sort of fascinated by all of the people who survive inside this extreme weather, but who are experiencing it, right, in some very unequal ways. And maybe just what that tragedy reveals, you know, about the sickness in some of our systems, right? The ways that we're really interknit with each other and with the natural world. I got the idea so long ago and really, I think, was too young or, you know, didn't have the skills to write this book. And it was during the pandemic that I kind of started from scratch again.
So once you know, and I assume that is one of the first things you know, that it's going to take place during the Dust Bowl. I mean, it could be, as you say, it could have been a hurricane, it could have been another natural disaster, but you settle on this very rich history of the Dust Bowl.
Yes. And you know, it's, I used to joke that this book was like Drylandia, my rebound book. It took me so long to get out of Florida, Joe. Like I didn't see snow until I was 19. And then I like spent all of my 20s writing that novel. So I was like, I'm done with Florida. I'm going to go somewhere new. And in this really, I don't know, surprising and inevitable way, I think the books really are in some ways the same story. I mean, Swamplandia is about this family who run an alligator park and they're about to lose their home. But if you widen the aperture, you can also see other dispossessions that precede their, you know, time in South Florida. So you can see kind of the U.S. war on the Seminole Nation, and the Miccosukee Nation. In this novel too, you know, they're the people that I think I grew up associating with the Dust Bowl or the Joads, you know, this Dust Bowl exodus of extremely poor and desperate, you know, white tenant farmers. And this is such a tragedy. And so I think part of the book too, that I didn't know when I started to write it, just the way like reconnecting that Dust Bowl exodus with the forced exodus of Native American families and communities from the plains, that started to feel sort of central to what the book wanted to explore, to kind of make that causal connection manifest. It wasn't the way I grew up thinking about this history.
So you are really coming in and looking at the aftermath in the sense of 1935 and Black Sunday and what comes after that of how these characters deal with this horrible thing that happened.
Absolutely. It's the aftermath of Black Sunday, and all of these various characters are experiencing really strange luck, strange fortune in different ways. So, as you mentioned, this Polish American farmer, it's almost like his farm is in this bubble of luck. I was riffing a little bit on the Book of Job, if you know that.
Sure.
And he's just, it seems like all the swerves and plagues, everything is swerving to avoid him, or that's his experience. And he doesn't irrigate. This is a dry land farmer. They haven't had any rain, and somehow his wheat is still growing. So he feels like Job. He's bewildered and frightened by what feels like an extraordinary run of luck. You know, there's this prairie witch character who has been storing and absorbing people's memories for them, and she goes bankrupt. So she wakes up bankrupt. She doesn't have any of the lifetimes that she's been. She's sort of a living memory bank for this town. It would be like if the library caught fire or something, right? She has to start counterfeiting memories to return to her customers because there's a run on her bank, just like there is a panic, an economic panic. And she's struggling too with what this loss means. There's like a this feral girl who's lost her mother and is just really committed to still playing basketball, even as they're like, well, the season is canceled. There are, school is canceled. There's, an apocalyptic cloud of dust has swallowed our town, and that's the kind of kid she is. She's like, I think we still have practice, very committed.
It's what keeps her going.
What keeps her going? Yeah.
And then there is a photographer that comes in to town to sort of look at all of this, a Black photographer, which is fascinating for the time and brings with it its own issues as far as what she wants to cover and what her editors want her to cover.
Yeah, this is a fictional character, Cleo Alfrey, but really inspired by some of the New Deal photographers. I bet some of your listeners know Joe, like Dorothea Lange. Her
Sure.
correspondence is a big inspiration to me. She is so independent, and there's often a struggle, artists and editors. It's a fraught relationship sometimes. And in Washington, they have a very specific story that needs to be told about this period. They're trying to document rural poverty, but also win support for some of the New Deal relief programs to demonstrate the need for them, but also the success for them. So there's always this tension in the project between wanting to introduce America to Americans and a kind of documentary aim, and then sort of the need to make propaganda for the New Deal. And that was really interesting to me. It feels resonant with a lot of some of our ongoing debates today around, the media, right? Fake news, not totally knowing how to verify or caption the images that they're receiving. Gordon Parks, who doesn't take photographs during the Depression, but his books, A Choice of Weapons, I mean, he was a huge inspiration too. And one of the remarkable things about this program is Roy Stryker did hire single women like Marian Post Wolcott. He hired Gordon Parks, an African American man. And they went out with their cameras and they created an amazing composite picture of our country. But also, it's a heavily curated one. I mean, there is an editor in Washington who put a literal hole punch through some of these negatives. And sometimes it's like an aesthetic choice, like he goes with the stronger photograph in his opinion. Sometimes it's clearly a more of a political calculation.
Another voice that we hear in the novel is the Scarecrow, which we realize that the Scarecrow is the character that is sort of watching over all of this.
Yeah, that's maybe one of my favorite characters, Joe. Sort of a perverse choice for a point of view character because, it's a straw doll staked to one spot. The drama there is a different kind of drama, right? Like, I feel like that's how we all feel on a Sunday, probably. He's got kind of a limited purview, but in other ways, I thought, well, this character really has an eternal vantage on this. It's a spirit trapped inside a scarecrow. It blinks awake during the Black Sunday duster. And for a lot of the novel, I think both the scarecrow character and the reader are not so sure who or what or why it is.
About that, you like that in the sense of you want to create that.
Yeah, this felt important to me. I think some of the questions the Scarecrow is asking have echoes among the other characters. I mean, they're all really united in this mystery that's happening in this town. And they're all sort of baffled in different ways by their own fortune. And I think the Scarecrow, the spirit is just wondering, like, is this a punishment? Is this a blessing? Did I just snag here like a tumbleweed? Why me is a question that kind of echoes across sections for a while. Or like, what am I meant to do with my life, with my lifetime? Like, what brought me to this threshold and what's required of me? I think these are some pretty universal questions. I think I liked having this other vantage onto the land that has a like a longer timeline in some ways, and isn't, you know, there's a lot of drama happening in each of the other characters' life. For this particular character, it's these huge kind of ontological questions about how do we know this world we share, like how much it matters what we name things. You know, there's a, he's sort of inspired by Beckett's Molloy, which is like a really dark, hilarious, wonderful book. But there's a line in that book, all I know is what the words know. So this character is almost like an amnesiac in some ways, like memories are coming back to him, but really in the form of language. I think that was interesting to me as well, sort of when you have accumulated enough of a substrate of memory to start inventing things, to start imagining.
Karen Russell is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is The Antidote. It is published by Knopf. We're introduced to the Prairie Witch, and I think to myself, oh, okay, here we go. Like this is here's Karen Russell. This is going to be good. And the Prairie Witch is such a fascinating character because I mean, for myself as a reader, I never questioned it. Like it was just, this is who this person is. This is what they do. And the detail that you give of what their role is in the lives of people of this community of us, Nebraska, is so beautiful, but so detailed as to what she does and what the citizens get out of it.
Yeah, I'm so happy it reads that way to you. I mean, I sort of write like a child writes, I think sometimes. Like, I really need to make some of this abstract stuff pretty literal. So, that process, you know, of like what you exile from your waking consciousness just to go on living on a Wednesday, I bet we all participate in that in ways that we do and do not know about, right? Like,
Right.
I am like, I've got my Clydesdale blinders on, you know, when I'm going to get my kids from school, and I've got, you know, that there are things that I think we're just not tuned into. And there are things in everybody's past. I think if you could tear out like a page of your life story and just put it on the shelf temporarily, wouldn't you do it? Like, I think everyone has things in their histories that are just difficult to know, to go on knowing and carrying. So I thought this lady would do a brisk business in the West. You know, there's a network of these prairie witches in my mind, and it's almost like a banking network. And that's how they operate. People whisper secrets to them, like these things that they just, they're too precious or they're too frightening or it's too hard to go on knowing them. And they just leave that person's consciousness and they go into the vault of this woman. And my idea is like you could read the deposit slip backwards and it'll just return to you. But until that time, you don't even know what you deposited. You're really free. You're lighter on your feet.
The Prairie Witch says that she's been absorbing and storing my customers' memories, banking secrets to sins and crimes, first and last times, nights of unspeakable horror. And that is a place where people try to remove it from themselves. It seems the question you were asking there is one that we grapple with and certainly seem to be grappling with now, which is when we say, okay, we're going to make a choice and we're going to forget this part of our past.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting. I'm launching this book. There's a section called The Counterfeiters. This witch and this girl decide they're running like a counterfeiting operation because customers are coming to get their pass back. There's like, you know, they're pulling up stakes. They want to get their deposits back. And this prairie witch has nothing to return to them. So they start making some bespoke lies for people, you know, some fantasies and just returning those. You know, it doesn't go well. But I was so struck writing this. I mean, I guess I talked about this a little bit, Joe, but just the omissions in my own understanding of our history when I was a kid, or the ways I didn't connect certain events, right? So maybe I would learn about the Trail of Tears in one unit, And then I learned about the Dust Bowl in another unit. I didn't see one as a cause of the other, not just its antecedent. I think right now, right where there's so many contests about how we name and know our country, I'm just thinking about the Gulf of America here, right? Like, I mean, this is still playing out today. And I think sometimes some of this stuff can be so private, like inside of families. My dad is a Vietnam vet, for example. I didn't grow up hearing much about that war, although I experienced its long afterlife in different ways. And I think about, the cargo veterans carry. A lot of that is unspeakable. We don't really give people pathways back. We don't really reckon with that on at a societal level. And that feels like a tragedy to me. So there were different ways that I just found myself really thinking about the costs of our economy, for example, that people bear in their bodies, the Dust Bowl, right, where a lot of these farmers are, they fail during this period, like millions of people lose their homes. And that failure is so individual, right? They experience it that way, instead of something that if you could treat it at a societal level, we might redraw some of these lines.
You write in the book, this is from the Prairie Witch. I hadn't known, no one had ever told me that I was a soldier in a war. That goes to what you were just saying about war itself, but also that realization that I think we all are grappling with and at times in our lives realizing that, yeah, this seems like it's a battle. We didn't want it to be a battle, but it's a battle.
It's a battle. And it's interesting today, Florida, my home state, you see what's happening with book banning, with the banning of different ways of teaching our history. It makes sense to me, having written this book, that that's where the front lines of the war are, right? In libraries, in schools, in bookstores, also over, women's bodily autonomy. I mean, this is where I think that contest for the future is playing out today.
Well, federal agencies are telling people to just take words, phrases, anything that they find offensive and to scrub those words. And so, in reading this novel, as all of that is happening, you of course think to yourself, okay, well, what do we do? But also that thought of, well, you really can't, for those of us who've lived it, they can try to take away the story, but we still have that lived experience.
Right. It's true. And there have always been journalists, historians. There have always been people who are insisting on the truth, right? Or on counter narratives to the ones that support a pretty unequal and ugly, unjust status quo. I mean, I've never been more grateful than I am today for, independent journalists. And you're so right, Joe. I mean, I have a friend who works for the NIH, and I saw the list of the words that have to now be scrubbed from grant applications and public documents. And it's very frightening. It's incredibly frightening. And I just have to hope that there is this countervailing movement. I mean, we see it, right? There is an immune response right now, I think, in our court system and but also on the ground, in ordinary citizens who are trying to resist some of that counterfeited reality and those redactions.
Karen Russell is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Antidote and published by Knopf. It seems, if we wanted to look into this, that you're almost doing the opposite, that you're taking what is lost and reminding us as readers, instead of taking it away, bringing it back to us and sort of giving us our deposits and saying, here you go.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, the tricky thing about writing a book like this one is that it could never fully restore all of the knowledge that's been suppressed or distorted or omitted. I really did start to feel it's a little bit different than other things I've written. I mean, it has a real intention, this book. And in some ways, I found myself thinking, oh, it kind of reproduces the tension in this file of photographs that are both, they have a documentary aim, but they also are kind of propaganda. I mean, I know I let Cleo, the photographer, my connection to that character was just starting to feel how she is working with the people and the places that she's photographing, but also with an eye towards like, well, what kind of future would we want to inhabit? Like, what could this place look like if we got it right now, if we started to make real change? I mean, social change also, not just restoring ecologies, rebuilding the soil. And that was a real question of mine in this book too. And it just seemed to me, looking at this history, you're not going to get to the right solutions if you don't have an honest look at the causes and drivers of this environmental collapse, one of which is absolutely colonial violence. And I mean, ecological imperialism continues to be a driver of a really global soil erosion crisis today. Soil's not that sexy, so I feel like, and it's, we have so much to be concerned about, But this is, I mean, that's the base of our whole existence, Joe. That's what makes everything happen here, is just a few inches of fertility in the soil that's being lost so rapidly. So people don't need, I mean, I think I was also just thinking like the dire warnings, I think, can paralyze people. So the good news or the hopeful news to me was that it's like you don't have to join Elon Musk's space fleet. You can just follow the lines that exist, right? This life cycle that exists that took billions of years to evolve, and where people are supporting it, there really is abundance. And so that was, I felt sincere hope sort of going out to some of these places where people are putting organic matter back into the soil and their local cooling effects, and you can just see flourishing intact nature. And so it's not, it's sort of like the solutions are here, they're right under our feet. The harder project, I think, is like the kind of social change that is inseparable if your goal is to heal the natural world. Like, I think writing this book also made me more aware of how you can't disaggregate that from working for to make the world more just for people.
We've been talking, rightfully so, we've been talking a lot about the story. I'd love to talk for a moment about the language. The reason that this works as a long novel is because it's gorgeous. It's so beautiful. The language is so beautiful. And the way that you are able to take these historic moments and so many different subjects and deep subjects of whether it be the Dust Bowl or an institution for unwed mothers or the Polish immigrants who settled in Nebraska, that you are able to take that and make those stories so rich and important and something that we can't look away from.
Thank you so much, Joe. That means a lot to me. I really love sentences. Like, I love the music of sentences. It's why I wanted to write in the first place. I have a little 5-year-old, and she, like, speaking of basketball, she'll walk around just dribbling words, She'll be like, lemon, lemon, lemon. And it's like clear that the sound itself is just like causing some yellow explosion inside her. And I love watching that because it is incredible, right? The sound and the sense of this medium that we get to work with if we're writers. And I'm always kind of reading out loud. Even when I read from this book now, I'm making edits still. So I'm glad it's good. It's good that it's left my desktop. I think my children thought I was like, Jack from The Shining. They were like, "You still working on that same book?" Oh.
Does that help you when you're writing to read it out loud to hear how it
Oh
sounds?
my God, for sure. I think part of it is, it is like a music that you're scoring for someone's breath in the weirdest way. My son, we're talking about that because he's just learned how to read. He's in second grade. So he's obsoleted me, right? He doesn't need me to read anymore, which is kind of sad, but it's thrilling. And he was like, "Mama, I hear these words in a different voice than my outside voice," which was like a scary thing. But
But
it's
a
true for
beautiful
all of us.
thing. I mean, it's
Not a
beautiful,
beautiful
though.
thing. A beautiful, it's so private, but I guess all to say it's still an auditory experience, primarily. So I do think you learn something. Yeah, I always learn where there's like a stagnant pocket when I'm reading a draft out loud, you just hear sort of like, we're like, "Oh my God, we're still having dinner. We gotta let's."
Let me wrap up with this because you just said this is kind of a throwaway, and I just want to grab it again, which is, you're glad to get this thing off your desk because you're still revising it as you read it. What is it like to finish a book? I mean, in the sense of when you are done, when you're done with this process of promoting it and you're starting, whatever, or getting more involved in the next project, of what that is like to pass it on.
You know, this is, I've never had an experience like this one. This book I got the idea for when I was so young. So it really feels emotional to let it go. I mean, I also, these dusty people frustrated me for like years at a time. But now that it's done, I do feel, I don't know, some kind of postpartum way about it, I guess. I'm grateful that other readers will know this world and these characters. I'm really proud of the ending and relieved. I feel grateful that I found that ending. It feels correct to me in a way that's rare for me with other things I've written. And so I feel like I did what this book wanted me to do, and that does feel good. It's interesting. I'm trying to write short stories now again, and I was so excited to return to them on my desktop. And I do sort of feel like, you know, when you go back to your house after you've been away for a while and it smells weird and you're like, who made all these decisions? And that's how I feel inside these story drafts. I was like, wow, this was interesting to me in 2022, you know? Like, so I'm still trying, I guess I'm, yeah, trying to reacclimate to a shorter form right now.
I love how you say you found the ending.
That's how it felt. I mean, not to seem sound too kind of woo-woo and mystical about it, but I really felt like for this particular book, that was the place to land. And I had help, of course. You know, I had my brilliant editor, Jordan Pavlin, my husband. I had wonderful readers, but I'm really, it's mysterious, right? I think that feels musical too. It felt like the right chord.
Karen Russell's new book is The Antidote. It is published by Knopf. Karen, you're an absolute delight. I thank you so much for this beautiful work and for sharing with us. It's such a treat to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'm going to finish the next one sooner so I can come back sooner. I love getting to talk to you about books.
Karen Russell's new novel is The Antidote, published by Knopf. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.